Grade 2 Conference, Lecture 10, The Second Grader, Part 10, in which we will take a final look at the temperaments and bring our discussion of the choleric in particular to a close. Cholerics live for challenges. They're not interested in anything, or not very much of anything, unless there's a great challenge there. And this is why they go out into the world of sports, and they love to take up really difficult tasks. Competitiveness is their middle name. And they will be, they and often their parents then will probably be the first ones to violate the school's policy that children cannot belong to a team until they're in 12th grade or something like that, or, can't be in Little League or Hockey League or whatever. They don't care. They're probably already in such a league and probably have been since kindergarten. And once again, you may have to make an exception there, because just as a sanguine is probably going to be taking ballet lessons no matter how many eurythmy classes she has and how many objections you make, because it's part of her nature to be active in that way, so the choleric is going to probably be involved in sports, competitive sports, hardcore competitive sports, much earlier than anyone else. If they're not in that, they're probably going to be playing video games at a very young age, because again, that competitiveness, that challenge is something they want. So how can you make drawing in a main lesson book a challenge? How can you make reciting a poem really well, or moving that poem really well, or a part in a play challenging? You always have to be bringing challenge to that choleric child. And we can look at this in another way. Tom Hartman, in his books about attention deficit disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, has brought up the fact that once upon a time, humanity at large, in general, we were all hunters and gatherers. And then over epochs, things evolved, and the settlers took over, the farmers. And instead of polygamy, one had monogamy. And instead of polytheism, we had monotheism. And instead of going out every day and hunting and depending on our ability to see everything around us and be poised and ready and facing every kind of challenge imaginable all the time, we settled down and decided that sitting at desks and filling out ditto sheets was actually the highest that a human being could aspire to. And we could say that the choleric child is someone who by destiny is reminding us that we are not only Jacob figures, as you'll see in grade 3, but we also have Esau living within us, and we need Esau. And we could say that today, how many people who work in offices all week long spend their weekends, climbing mountains and heliskiing and surfing and doing things in which they're risking their life and limb constantly, because that Esau side, that hunter-gatherer side, that risk-taker, is not recognized in our culture. Very little is given to cultivate that. And though Waldorf schools have wonderful things about them, obviously, you wouldn't be here and neither would I if we didn't love Waldorf education, we still are a school. We still have desks, even if you have one of those movable classrooms. We still expect the children to sit still for long periods of time and read and write and all of this stuff. It's amazing how little we actually differ from most other schools a lot of what we do, though it's more artistic and more spiritually infused, it's pretty recognizable to any other teacher. This is a schoolroom. The choleric needs something more. And I think we are at a very primitive state in Waldorf education in terms of how to really meet cholerics. My feeling is that schools need to professionalize the role of the buildings and grounds person, and that that person who every day is facing some kind of challenge in the school's boiler room or raking leaves or shoveling snow, or you could tell what part of the country I come from, but you know, all of the things that a buildings and grounds person has to face, that maybe the choleric spends an hour every day out of the classroom and with that person, just so that we acknowledge that the choleric child needs something more than the sedentary classroom can provide. This is something, of course, that goes beyond the bounds of our conference time, but it's something for you to think about. I don't think that choleric children would be such major problems, and believe me, they are in Waldorf schools across the country. I don't think it must be that way. I think that they are showing up one of our grave weaknesses and one of our short-sighted qualities, that we are not enough in the will, but we are very, very content to just remain on the level of thinking, feeling, and all of the soul forces connected to those, but we have not yet really penetrated the will. So this is something for us all to give some thought to. It would be nice to have more than just sort of academic discussions of what the will is about, but to see some real changes affected in the life of schools so that something more could arise from this. And I would say, if you go to Europe, I've been to many schools in Great Britain. It's amazing to see there how much of their funding and time and energy they devote to things like blacksmithing and metalwork, even on the grade school level, and how much the students do in terms of building buildings in the school and, you know, being able to really work with their will forces. It's so interesting. We think of Europe as being much more in the head and America as the country of the will, but educationally, it's quite the opposite. So if you ever have a chance to see what's over there in many schools, and also in a very exceptional, remarkable place called Ruskin Mill, which is in the Cotswolds, in the more western side of England, the work that they do with autistic and autistic spectrum students there, very much in the realm of the will and the arts and the will. So this would all be very helpful to us, I think, if we started to look at constituting our schools perhaps a little bit differently, and even in the primary schools, trying to awaken much more to the needs of the four temperaments, because we're sort of losing touch with that. It's one of the most valuable tools that Steiner gave us, one of the most valuable arrows in our quiver that's there waiting to be used, and teachers just shrug and tell me, I can't understand what temperament he is, or I really can't tell the children apart temperamentally, and they just let it go, and then they wonder why they're struggling with behavior and the quality of the students' work and why the students are leaving in grade 6 or 7. And so much of it has to do with our underutilization of the temperaments. The funny thing is, the irony, maybe it's not really that funny, is where you hear the most talk about the temperaments, two places. One is in the faculty meeting, where suddenly everybody's an expert on the temperaments of the children in their class. When you're doing a child study, suddenly, oh yes, well, it's that, you know, very, very sanguine side there. She just can never get anything done. But this is often when they're talking about children in the upper grades who actually are not nearly as affected by their temperament as when they were in the younger grades. So it comes in the faculty meeting in the most inappropriate times, really, when it can help us understand the child much at all. The other place that I'm always hearing the temperaments described is in the teacher's lounge, when teachers are talking to or about one another. They're always telling each other, well, yeah, you're so choleric, you know, you're always saying that, and I don't agree at all, or, you know, here he comes in his phlegmatic way, late to the meeting again. And there again, these are adults. If all we can see in another adult is their temperament, there's something very wrong with that person. I mean, there's something almost mentally ill about them, and there's something very wrong with us if that's the only thing that presents itself when we look or see that person. But everybody's got the temperaments of their colleagues down pat, another area in which it is really not very helpful. In fact, it actually obfuscates our understanding of another adult. So that's what's so odd, that our talk about the temperaments, our expertise about the temperaments, is completely displaced, where we really need to talk about them and understand them is grades 1, 2, and 3. After that, there are other factors that come to the fore, and certainly not in talking about adults. So this is a big challenge that we have, but I hope that you will rise to it in a choleric way and meet it. I think you will find it will make your work as a good sanguine delightful, and give you a variety, the rich variety of children in your class. And finally, you'll be able to relax a little bit, not be so tense and always be so nervous about what the children are going to present today. You know, you can have a little bit of good phlegmatic comfort out of this. And in the end, realize that it's all kind of little bit hopeless anyway. What will be, and not much you can do about it. You know, we're all basically heading to the same place sooner or later, right? So that melancholic in you will realize this as well. Well, so much for all of that. Let's go on then from the little challenge of working with the four temperaments to the real challenge that we face in our work as teachers, working with parents.